Hi folks, this is the recording of the Tortoise Shack Live Echo Chamber section from our gig on the 10th of November in Dublin Sugar Club. It was a fantastic night, and we did it as safely as we could. We undersold the places to space it out. We had table service. We kept people masked. We checked COVID certs, and we even had a CO2 monitor in attendance. We hope to do it again. But on the night, I was joined by an incredible panel, and I'm not just saying that, I mean genuinely knock your socks off incredible panel of people, including the inclusion health social worker Neva Rourke from James's Hospital, who does Trojan work, as you'll hear on the podcast. We're also joined by GP Mark Murphy, who gives fantastic insights into Sláinte care, and as you'll hear, Mark is a little bit of a Doctors for Appeal hero as well. We're also joined by infectious disease and inclusion health consultant in James's Hospital, Cliona Ní Chealaigh, who you'd probably know has contributed to this podcast regularly and does phenomenal work with that team. And then on top of that, we were joined by the PBP's resident nerd and PhD researcher into resilience and into vaccine resilience at the moment, Conor Reddy. So we covered all of the aspects of it, be it Sláinte care, be it COVID response, be it trauma, inequality, the impacts it has on health. We talked vaccines and vaccine inequality. I can't stress how grateful I was to be able to share the stage with these people and actually let them take over. I hope you really enjoyed it, because I felt energized after it. If you want to attend these events, if you want to get first ups about them, if you want to get extra content, if you want to get them as they're released, and more importantly, if you just value the work that we do, it would really help if you go to patreon.com/tortoiseshack. And actually help us out. Just join us, click a level there, give us what you think is a fair value for the work that we do every month. The project itself relies totally on you, the listener. There's no ads, there's no sponsors. If you get sick of listening to me ask for these things, imagine how sick I am having to do it all the time. But I really believe that the project matters. I really believe in the work that my colleagues and this little community does, and no more so than the last few days when we've talked to Kira's story about living as a disabled person living in her car, and trying to help her get her story out. And we'll have more updates on that hopefully in the coming days. But if you think that this matters, help it stay alive. It's patreon.com/tortoiseshack. And I'll let you get to what I believe to be one of the best panels I've ever assembled. Thanks for the support. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye. anybody got some baby oil? So we're in the wrong audience to ask that. No. Guys, very short notice and apologies. It's just me tonight. Unfortunately, Martin's father is unwell and he wants to be here. The gobshite thought he could actually be here, but he knows he needs to be beside his dad at this moment. And I've decided that rather than him not be here, I'm going to read a little thread he did about his dad in 2018. So if you could indulge me for a few seconds. Martin wrote this in in November 2018, and it's my da. I call him da, dad, or pops. No particular reason. Just habit. He's a great da, always has been. We don't always agree. Probably fair to say we seldom do. But he's still a great da. When I was on chemo, he drove me in every day, dropped me off, waited for me. When I had to have operations, I got him to drop me off the door of the hospital. No tears allowed. No fuss, just do it. When I was close to death, 7 stone, his was the first face I saw. There, holding my hand, lost in his own way, but there, he was there for me. Just yesterday, I pranked the old banger I drive. Within hours, my dad had me on his insurance and drove the car over to me. Dad isn't getting any younger. His kidneys are failing. His health has gone downhill. And the last few years, it's not been good. But he's still as sharp as a tack. He can cut the legs out from you under with a comment, and he will hate that I've written this. The reason I've written this is because Da starts dialysis in the new year. He's scared, reluctant, and is kind of pretending it's not happening. So if you come across him, say hi, have a chat with him. He loves to talk. His name is Joe,
And I love him very much. Anyway, hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. Now, look, this, I am absolutely thrilled. I have a fabulous panel. I genuinely have a fabulous panel, and I'm totally at sea how I'm going to introduce these people, because every one of them is intellectually my superior, knows more, and whose phone's ringing? But I am thrilled, because the simple fact is, when we started the podcast, we spoke about, you know, talking to people who maybe weren't known in other aspects of the media, or weren't covered in aspects that weren't covered. And some people who were heroes, and some of these people, apart from Connor, are heroes. So it is my pleasure to introduce to the stage Niamh O'Rourke, Cliona Ní Chaillig, Mark Murphy, and Connor Reddy. Come on up, folks.
Thanks, Chris.
No pressure, lads.
No. First of all, thank you for coming. And I want to start this off by saying I don't want to be COVID heavy, Cliona, but we are still in the era of COVID. So I suppose it would be only fair to mark that in the context of a podcast where, with a live audience here, of your experience on a COVID ward over the last 18 months, it's fair to say, has probably changed your opinion of medicine and how it should be done in Ireland.
Yeah, I think what it really brought home to me was how much, I don't know, how much I really value the normal Irish approach to people who are dying. Like, you know, Martin is with his dad. No matter what happens tonight, he's sitting there with him. And I think that is something that is very strong in our culture, particularly in working class Dublin, for example, like where James's is. To not have that is really hard, not only for the people and their families, but it's actually really hard for the staff to witness. Because I think as Irish people, we really value community and connection, and to see people having to die on their own is very difficult to see. And it made me really value some of my colleagues. I work with a nurse called Tony. He's a legend. I don't know if you'll ever hear this.
He's the best nurse ever.
Well, apart from Anne-Marie and Jess.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
He's the best nurse that doesn't work in our office ever. But he would sit and sing people's favourite songs to them. And, like, that's what you want. That's what's important.
And to take that...
And he has a good singing voice, even though he doesn't think he does.
Well, we'll leave that to the listener when we get an opportunity. But if I could come to you, Niamh, because the work... You work with Cliona in the Inclusion Health Service, and we saw... I recall... 18 months ago, 20 months ago now at this stage, where, because all of the work you guys were doing with people who were vulnerable, maybe suffering with addiction, had been through trauma, and all of these things that have made an impact on their lives, we saw the state could actually ramp up overnight. And now we see overnight the state's going, let's go back to normal.
Yeah, I suppose... Today I mentioned to Cliona in our office that I felt like things were really tentative in the hospital at the moment, and it feels like things are in heavy winter, but without COVID happening, but without all the additional supports that were put in the early stages. So I suppose it's just really challenging to see how things can be put in place. Like, for example, in homeless services, people were given shielding opportunities, were given addiction workers, were provided with onward accommodations out of homelessness. But now we're still in a point of COVID where these people are still very vulnerable, whereas those resources aren't as readily available. So it's kind of back to the old times, unfortunately. And
which is, they want you to ignore the evidence of your own eyes. Because it's Cleena, you, when we spoke, and I hate to be that guy who says, when we spoke at the beginning of this, we'd spoken previous, before COVID started, and you had told us about people who were going through the inclusion process in James's Street, and then the difference when overnight things changed. And forgive me for my poor impersonation, but one guy had said to you, oh man, it's like MTV Cribs.
Oh yeah, that was brilliant. But like for him, he'd been in a tent in a cemetery for years, like having his own room with a door that he could lock and his own toilet and shower was like MTV Cribs, which is pretty scandalous. He's doing really well. But I think like what you said is so true. It showed that saying that things aren't possible wasn't true. Mm-hmm. Like it was possible to put the people who needed their own room and their own toilet and a door that locks into that facility. It is possible, you know, to take the cap off methadone numbers so that anybody who needs methadone can get it. So I just think we need to be cautious about going back to thinking that things aren't possible when they are.
Which brings me to Mark. Mark, you have been actively involved in the Sláinte Care process. We've seen, and I'm going to broaden this out because listeners to the podcast will understand that we talk about Sláinte Care in terms of an all-Ireland health service. There's all this talk at the moment right now of we're going to have a border poll. We're going to have all of these things. And every single guest we have, whether they're unionist, nationalist, whatever it is, they do not want to know unless we can do something that has something that's even the equivalent of the NHS, imperfect as it is. Mark, where do we stand in terms of Sláinte Care?
Like, There is something rotten in Irish society. We're a wonderful country. We've got wonderful people, but I think, and I don't mean this politically, in terms of a party political preference, but we don't have a social democracy in this country, and we've just heard from Niamh and Cleena, first and foremost, that the political, economic, and social lives in which we live determine our health, where we live, the transport, what we're hearing in the past 2 days about the national transport plan for the next 20 years, how we cycle to work, the air that we breathe, the house that we live in, and the patients who see me, that show me the photographs on their phone of this appalling accommodation, and the, you know, spiral of lack of hope and lack of dignity. Like, it's a fallacy for me to be thinking about holistic, patient-centered care when that economic and social fabric is a disgrace. And I think that's why we're, you know. Now, it's obviously hard to come up with a solution, but we have to be optimistic. We have to believe that we can come up with that solution. But on that slice that I can control, which is healthcare, which is sitting in front of a person, again, we're compounded again. It's a disgrace. About a third of the presentations that I see are directly related to mental health and addiction. There is really an appalling service. We have no primary mental health service, which is GP-based. It's totally fragmented. It's chaotic. I also work in the addiction services. And, you know, as Niamh said, those resources aren't there. We can do better. And Tony, you've just pointed to one country. You could point to every other country in the OECD that provides dignity of access, where children aren't waiting for 2 years for an early intervention assessment, where children aren't waiting for years for scoliosis treatment. This is disgraceful. And we're kind of using these plaudits and words to say that we can come up with another plan. Well, Sláinte Care was that plan. Simply put, we need access to GPs in primary care. It should be universal. And we need to resource and govern better our public healthcare resources. And we can't skirt around the governance issue. As social democratic individuals, we not only do we want better and more public healthcare, but it needs to be governed better, and we can talk about that. But I believe it can happen. I believe it can happen. And I believe that most doctors want it to happen. I believe that most social workers want it to happen. I believe nurses want it to happen. But mostly, I think the country want it. And I think the kind of how it's been coming apart at the seams for the past 2-3 months is incredibly depressing. And the wonderful thing about advocates like Cleena is that she can say, we need Sláinte Care, with an optimistic slant. We can do it. We can do it, and every country does it.
I don't know how you do it.
It's the drugs.
If you were a long-term listener, you will know Clina has shared stories before, and Niamh, you've spoken powerfully about the people that you interact with on a daily basis. But I want to get narrowed out for a little while, because Connor, you're the scientist, the PhD grad who looks at the resilience, and part of that project has been looking about, and I have to say it, because was our 500th episode we did, and I kind of sprung it at you, wasn't it?
Yeah. The day before, I think. Yeah. So like this, actually.
Yeah. For those who were here,
I text
Connor and I sent him the picture of the Sugar Club, and he said, "Oh, great, who's on?" I said, "You are." That is gospel truth. Yeah. But Connor, the idea of resilience and what these processes that people are speaking to, trauma, poverty, inequality, what they do to people, it actually means lower life expectancy.
Yeah, absolutely. So these things, they get under the skin. They become biological. The social becomes biological. So I'm actually, Clina is my supervisor, so I feel like I'm in an exam here and I'm being scrutinised.
I'm taking marks.
Yeah, so our research looks at how this happens. It looks at what the mechanisms are that, I guess, integrate traumas and stresses of day-to-day life to actually affect people's health. And what we've seen so far is that homeless people experience a far faster rate of aging. So our research tells us that homeless people experience age-associated conditions 20 or 30 years earlier than people in the general population. So it's things like dementia, cancer, cardiovascular disease, much, much earlier. And I mean, that makes sense to all of us who know people in homelessness who've experienced that trauma. But what we want to be able to see is how that happens, how it happens at a biological level. So stress seems to be the major factor here. Stress actually biologically is bad for your health.
The telomere.
Surprise. The telomere is part of it, yeah. But it's really the immune system, I think, is what we focus on, and how you get this kind of dysregulated, very inflamed type of immune system when you're exposed to trauma and stress is a different kind. So that's what we do.
And if I could ask, come to you, Niamh, on that, you literally are the front line with a lot of people who have had inadequate resources, who have been let down by society, and this is the reality of trauma. And then you've trauma impacted on trauma. I mean, people say, oh, they were in addiction. It's like, put me on the street for 2 weeks. I would gladly take whatever it takes to forget about it. When you have those things happening in front of you, and you guys work together, so you know the science of it, it must be incredibly frustrating to see there. And yet uplifting when you work with individuals, because I know you've seen the spirit of these people who society have cast off.
Yeah, I suppose as a social worker, what always gets to me is when we talk about things from just a biological deterministic fashion, because as Connor said, the social becomes biological. I always have a quote, and I've said it to Clina before, people create worlds and then those worlds create people. So what that essentially means is that the social for people become biological. It creates that person in that world. And I suppose what is really challenging for having worked in social work across pediatrics, child welfare, and in emergency medicine and inclusion health is that you're seeing the same people at different points in their life course with the same issues and the same crap resources that hasn't affected enough change for people. So what you're seeing is, like, I've met people in child welfare and then I've met their parent in the emergency department in St. James's with this very similar issue, and they're different clients for me across different
times.
So the
trauma is different, but it's intergenerational.
Intergenerational. I'm from an area where there's a huge amount of intergenerational trauma. There's huge levels of addiction. I go to the shop around the corner from my house and I see some of our guys, and I often then ring the Rough Sleepers team and say, I found him. I can tell you exactly where he is. But you'd also know locally that across communities, you know that there's certain families that have experienced much more intergenerational trauma. We have a history. I was don't mean to laugh around the sex therapist side of things. She was speaking about shame in relation to sex. But what we see in the hospital system and what we see in our client groups is the internalization of shame upon shame over generations, and compounded by structures. Because I'll go to them as a social worker and say, I know you need help to get home and you might need a home care package in your home, but I know I won't be able to get those carers in place. I spoke with someone recently who has a neurological disorder and needs care at home. They're under 65. I know it's going to be impossible to get that care package from a disability service because we don't fund things for under 65s, even though that person deserves that care and deserves to be at home. So what you're seeing is the across the life course though, and across intergenerations, levels of trauma, but you're seeing a compounding and a pushing down from the system to tell people over and over again, yes, we know you have that need. Yes, we identify that need. We're still not going to give it to you. You're still not worth it. And that's what we're telling people as a system. And we're the front face of that. And every day, myself and my nursing colleagues on the inclusion health team manage people's expectations and say, I know I can see what you need, but realistically, this is what we can look at and this is what I can achieve for you. And then we'll take the next step together next time. And I'll send you to Mark to get your primary healthcare needs met, and I'll send you to someone else.
And Mark, you're sitting there and you know that you're not resourced enough because in general practitioner world, you could be doing more with better resources if given the supports to do it, because you're in a conveyor belt.
Yeah, and I really need to, like, look, I'm in a really privileged position in society. It's a wonderful job, but it's hugely challenging. All I do is work. It's financially challenging, the company and business that the government forces me to run to be a GP.
Mark had the cycle over here at last minute, by the way, this evening, because he was literally working until all the hours God sends.
And it's great. It's such a privilege. I'm sure the four of us will agree. Working in the social and psychological and biomedical realm and having that lens into society, it affords you, and you can't help but be politically motivated by what you see. You can't help it. And I love being a GP, but it's very challenging. And I would say that it's suffering everywhere in the world. It's not just Ireland. And there is something about that first port of call when a family member is dying, when there's psychological trauma, distress, those weird symptoms. What's that rash? Who's that? What's that thing? And you should have a continuous relationship with someone that's accessible. It's a really important thing in healthcare to have a very well-qualified, compassionate, well-trained, good communicator professional in that role. Around the world, we need those physicians in China, in India, in Ireland. And the problem is around the world, is that we are getting more commodified, more privatized. We hear ads for consume healthcare in this hospital now. We hear ads from our insurance companies and our private providers saying, take me, take this healthcare. And that healthcare is probably over-medicalizing, harmful, and look, I have to be very careful in what I say because I've been, you know, there are challenging
outspoken
circumstances. No, but this is the world you live in. And if you do try and advocate, it's a really vicious, commodified environment. And we do need to protect a GP in local villages and towns where nurses, wonderful medical admin and GPs are able to be there so you can see them within the week. And that service, I'm afraid now, has crippled away in Ireland. And it's crippled away partly due to resources, but partly as well due to mismanagement. At a macro level, luckily, COVID has meant that doctors kind of are listened to at that top level. And in the past 10 years, good things have happened in terms of politics and GP. The chronic disease management has happened. But at a micro and meso level, I'm just going to be blunt. 3 years we've set up a practice. I have no meaningful interaction in any shape or form with any manager in primary care. I don't know how many podiatrists work in the local area. I don't know who the physiotherapists are. I send an email. I don't get an email back. Like, that is the kind of environment that I operate in, and it's very frustrating.
Can I push in on that? Because I recall as someone who was brought up in the north side of Dublin that it was revolutionary 25 maybe 30 years ago, I'm aging myself now, yeah. when Dr. Austin O'Carroll introduced a chiropodist on Brunswick Street, and everybody lost their minds because there was homeless people need their feet looked at, and everybody lost their minds. And yet it was one of the most important treatments that people could get because they were on the street, they were on their feet, and it was... Because I remember Austin when I was only a kid, and that guy, like he's in Czechoslovakia, he's in Prague at the moment, I think, at the addiction conference.
That's why he wasn't answering my call.
There you go. he answered mine and said no. But actually, it's funny. I mentioned Austin, and now I turn to Cliona. Do you know Cliona that Austin once said to me that when he goes to bed, he wears Cliona Ní Chealaigh's pajamas because you're his superhero.
Well, he's my like. I remember listening to him and I was like, oh my God, it all makes sense. So anything I do is really often down to Austin. He's amazing. But to go back to what Mark was saying.
Please.
I really think we need to think about how we fund and structure healthcare in Ireland. And I think the vast majority of people who work in healthcare in the public sector and possibly in the private sector on the ground want it to be state-funded and state-run. I don't think most GPs want to be business owners. I think they want to look after patients. I'm really lucky. I work in a public hospital. I don't have to balance the books at the end of the day. But I'm really worried about what's happening. And I'm worried as a doctor that doctors are going to be blamed for Sláinte Care not being implemented when the vast majority of people of my age and younger would absolutely love to work in a system that provides universal healthcare that's state-run and state-funded. So, you know, I want that to be written down somewhere.
Well, it's going to go out in the podcast now, so...
Yes, there in the historical record. But, like, we want to go into work and look after people. That's why we've chosen to do what we do. And I was talking to a friend of mine who's a surgeon about a very complicated patient this evening, and, like... You know, he was like, he can't get into theatre because there isn't the funding for the theatre staff and the ICU beds are full of COVID because we don't have enough ICU beds anyway. And the money is all going to be put into NTPF to fund private hospitals to do the surgery that he's paid to do and he wants to do. And it's not good enough. And if a relative of mine was really sick, I would tell them to steer away from a private hospital. And I do that because public hospitals deal with the complexity. They're staffed. And I really think we need to look at our models. And Niamh is great on this. She's told me it's all about a mixed model of...
Mixed economy of
wealth. Yes, that's it. That's it. Go,
Niamh. Go.
So essentially, it's a private-public partnership. It's everything in this country is a little bit public, a little bit private. But I always come back to I love Noam Chomsky. Always come back to what Noam Chomsky says around if you undervalue a public service enough, you will make people angry enough to want a service, and then you will sell them the commodified capitalist system service. And that's what's happened in Ireland. And even since I've been qualified as a social worker 10 years, it's a huge difference in what resources you were able to get 10 years ago for people from a public system than you're struggling to get from a private system now.
And putting that in mind now, and again, Connor, Connor's also politically affiliated to the yes, people who yeah. want to who want to end the capitalist system. So no more so. No harm. But Connor, when you see something like that and the work that you do, in you must see that the science is borne out by your day to day interactions with the people that you speak to yeah. politically.
Yeah, to an extent. I think there's an unfortunate thing in science where, like, the social world's completely written off. It's outside the black box. And that's what's been really nice about our work, that it actually does try to integrate social reality into science and an understanding of how nature works. So I think that's something that's really forgotten about. I do want to just go back to that question, though, of healthcare, because it's something I'm pretty passionate about, too.
I know.
And I guess the thing with Sláinte Care, all these laudable aims and objectives that we all want to see brought into reality, I think the problem with it, though, was that it was an attempt to take politics out of healthcare. That if you look at the establishment of the NHS in Britain, if you look at the establishment of any national health service, single-payer, universal service, it came on the back of mass mobilization, public demand. I think we're in a moment like that. I think we're out of a massive public health crisis where we've seen that the impossible could be done. And like we talked about that no going back thing now, I think the appetite is there to kind of push for more than all of the aims of Sláinte Care, definitely, but to push from below. Rather than to have a Department of Health or a HSE tell us how it's done, I think it's for us as a public to actually demand for it to happen and to push for creative ways to actually implement it, and for it to be people like Mark and Cliona and Niamh that are leading it.
Which brings me to Mark. Mark, when we push on the door, has the door just been is the door locked or is the door slightly ajar?
No, Sláinte Care is not in any way gone. It is on the table and it will happen because it has to happen. And like, whatever about the word Sláinte Care, and maybe, you know, sometimes these things grow some sort of semantic toxicity or something like that. We need a fairer, better healthcare system. And the way to do that is straightforward in my mind, and it's in a very big Sláinte Care report, but it's firstly dealing with the big social economic issues that determine our health, like early child years, like housing, childcare, education.
Poverty.
And poverty.
Poverty, yeah.
You know, so that's first and foremost. There's obviously a political angle to that, but that is first and foremost. After that, first port of call in the healthcare system, slowly but surely, and I'm an incrementalist, just increase the access to more bands of people to see a GP, funded properly, put in training grants for the practice nurses, who are kind of ignored, I think, in Ireland, and I think the INMO needs to step up and talk about practice nurses. They're such an important professional, key professional. They need pensions, they need proper supports. We need everyone in the country, slowly but surely, to have access to a GP, and we need that funded. After that, if you're unlucky enough to require secondary care, we need that integrated with, and that's not very complicated, you just have to have channels of communication with secondary care, and we need the beds, and we need the professionals to do that.
I heard you laugh there. I know, Connor, you want to come in, but Cliona.
The really important channel of communication is the mobile phone. Absolutely, yeah. It's not complicated at all. You just swap numbers often.
So it is, and Cliona and myself were emailing ourselves. Yeah. Like, we had integrated care last week. We're just emailing each other about a patient.
Hey, I mean, have you seen so-and-so? You know, no, I haven't. Okay, yeah. He's here.
So like, the most important thing is, there's a need. It's a massive need. It has to happen. And it's very straightforward how to do that. It's just incrementally we need to do it and fund it and plan it and govern. And there are obviously holes of bad governance, like any massive organization of 100,000 people.
As a non-incrementalist, I'm going to go to Connor.
Look, I think there's more at play, though. You look at GP care, you look at companies like Centric Health, who are eyeing up the GP market at the minute. You look at Dennis O'Brien and people like that in private healthcare. There's vested interests here that are really powerful and that have influence in the corridors of power that actually need challenging. Like, we can talk about all of these good ideas, but I think there needs to be a realisation that power concedes nothing without demand.
But power doesn't respect anything but power.
Exactly, and like, where's our power? Where's the power behind the good ideas?
Well, it goes back to what we've been talking about here. It's the fact that 18, 20 months ago, we all saw what was possible overnight. Yeah. Niamh, you worked with these people and you're sitting there and you're saying, we've actually improved their lot.
So at one point in myself and my nurse colleague, Anne-Marie Lawley, who is the best nurse ever, Cliona.
She actually is. And Jess.
Myself and Anne-Marie sat in an office and had been asked 5 times that day, where are all the homeless people?
Yeah.
We were asked that every day from about March of the start of the pandemic, because homeless persons were in 24-hour services where they had their nursing needs met, they had a GP visiting, they had their addiction needs met, they had meals on site. They didn't have to come to the hospital. They didn't need to use the unscheduled care of the ED because they mightn't have got around to Mark that week and this was an urgent need for them to attend a hospital. They didn't need to stay in the hospital overnight because they'd nowhere else to go, because they had places to go. Their basic needs were met. So therefore, the hospital system didn't see them. Therefore, that saved a huge amount of money.
That's what I was going to point out.
So every hospital bed day is €1,500 per night. in any hospital bed. That's the cost to staff it. That's the cost of cleaning me, whatever the professionals attend. And that's every single day, that's what the cost of a hospital bed is.
That's
so that was saved a huge amount of money.
We have to point back and say what you're doing is also, it's cruel and economically reckless.
It's both. And that's what gets me every time. And it's the same. I have friends who are economists and they're quite right wing. They're not here. They're in England. But anyway, that's a whole other issue. But they would have slightly different political views to my own. But they would say that the only thing that you should never privatise is healthcare, because all you're doing is doing more investigations and generating more ill health. So I think that's a really important point. And I forget how that was tied into what Niamh just said.
I can't remember what I said.
Yes, but that's what drives me mad. So Mark is talking about funding, you know, early childhood intervention, psychological interventions in the community. Those things save huge amounts of money. It costs 80 grand a year to keep somebody in prison, 240,000 a year for a child in foster care of the person who's in the prison.
64,000 euro a year to put a family into emergency accommodation.
Absolutely, that yields nothing. It's not even like the state has those buildings at the end of that tenancy. It's insane financially. And that's what kills me, because it doesn't save money and it causes suffering.
If I can say something about political leadership, and you know, like it's, I don't like
not very incrementalist, please.
Yeah, I have huge respect.
Can I just
respect.
Say, Mark is one of the reasons that we have abortion access for people in Ireland. Look, so Mark, he is Mark, my hero.
Mark is a great round of applause for Mark.
And that was a really brave thing for Mark to do.
Absolutely, and I agree. I'm just conscious of the audience, and I don't want him to rip him limb from limb when he keeps saying I'm an incrementalist.
Thank you, Cliona, and I would say like 400 GPs have stood up, and they are providing public health care, and women can access with issues. There are major issues. Women over 12 weeks still have to travel, by and large, several hundred women a year, and that's not on, and we need to move on, but it's positive, and that's great, and our wonderful obs and gynae colleagues who are supporting GPs. I do think that there's an issue at the senior levels of our government in terms of identifying what Connor said. To get maybe I'm not being so incrementalist anymore. I'm feeling like, let's call a spade a spade. Has the minister who has action over mental health ever verbalized that someone who comes to the GP who has anxiety, depression, or addiction has nowhere else to go except to pay me 60 euro? Mm. And is she saying that she's happy with that? And after that person sees me, if that person is a private patient, I will refer them for counseling, which will cost 1,000 euro a year, which is paid for out of pocket. And that is 95% of her mental health services. And I have never heard her acknowledge that or think about it or talk about it or say it's a problem or talk about what are we going to do to help that individual who's in crisis, who is, for some reason, their whole social life has collapsed around them. They come into me crying for half an hour and I charge them 60 euro. That's our mental health services. And I say, come back to me in a month and you'll have to pay for that. And if you can afford it, which they can't, I'll refer them to counselling. So let's take a look at the political leadership. They are not talking about the problems. And the problems are multitude in terms of mental health, in terms of access, in terms of particularly in relation to developmental delay in children.
Mark, I need to push in on that, because what's really funny is we see all the debate open up in the last few months about, you know, early childcare and paying a living wage to people who look after your kids before they go to school. Holy shit.
Just the most important job in the entire world.
And the rest of the world is like, oh, you do know for every euro you put in, you get 4 euro back in terms of, you know, in terms of educational attainment, social mobility. But we're still at this going, oh no, we might subsidise a few quid to that, Cliona. It must be insane when you see that and know that even financially and ethically, it's just horribly wrong.
And you're buffering, you know, Niamh has done loads of work with kids in difficulties. You're buffering the, you know, things may not be great at home because the parents aren't given the mental health supports that they need, but you can buffer that. And I think the thing that, one of the things that makes me and Niamh angry, and there are a lot of things, is seeing the loss of potential. You're like, you know, why didn't you give that person a chance? Look at all that potential that we wasted as a society. It's stupid.
And often we see their potential when they come to be known by an acute healthcare service.
Yes.
So when we're seeing them, like, if we're worried about people, if myself or Cliona or our nursing colleagues are worried about people in the inclusion health team, the average life expectancy is 12 months. Like, our experience has been that the lads that we're worried about in the last 3 years, that they die. And they die really young. They die
early. And they
early.
Had loads that they could have done. They weren't ready to die.
Find out about all the talents they had, like the pictures I have in my office that people have made and given to me just in the
Can I make one? I'm going to quote Mary McAuliffe, who's been on the podcast a few times, and I love to say it because it kills me every time I say it. The poor are convicted of poverty.
Absolutely. And punished. Yeah. We punish them for being poor. So not putting in the developmental supports, not putting in all, we're punishing people.
And the difference between, say, someone like myself that's from a very working class area that have all the same intergenerational stuff as some of our client groups and homeless services is one different chance.
Yeah.
And that every day I think, I'm so lucky that
you're,
I got that chance.
You're the outlier.
Yeah.
And you're supposed to be grateful, by the way.
I'm the 1% in my area that has done master's level education, and I'm meant to be grateful for that. But what it's just shown me is it's not good enough for the rest of the lads that I went to school with. It's not good enough for the ones I see at the around the corner. Because... How was I better than them? I'm not.
Can I bring up that elephant in the room then about class? Decisions are made based on a class basis because we've too few working class voices at the table at the decision making thing, and they're just not representative. Connor,
well, this is very true. what more can I say? I think class in Irish society is something that makes us all uncomfortable, but it's something that you can't help but be more aware of as time wears on, as these crises get deeper and deeper. There is something that structures our social experience. There is something that structures our chances in life. And I think by acknowledging that, you start to open up new possibilities and you start to, rather than tokenizing people, when you see that potential that's there, you can actually bring people forward to make change as a collective. And I think the power rests with those people that are sitting in situations that are often disempowered. And it's by, I guess, bringing them to the table that you start to unlock that potential and bring it to the fore.
But coming back to COVID, and I think, you know, what Connor is saying is so true. When you don't have diversity in decision making, you make really bad decisions. So you could see really clearly, first of all, there were no people who were women who
there
had responsibility
no
for children.
I'm aware Ola Hegarty is here, so she knows.
Good luck. But also, there weren't people who were living in households in which there were grandparents, parents and children, and potentially great-grandparents because they
and
are poor.
And the great-grandchildren out the caravan out the back that
absolutely.
They took over the
back
wall.
Absolutely, and you could see that nobody was thinking that these were high-risk environments for COVID jumping from kids to grandparents. So you could see really clearly the weakness that gives you, all the blind spots that you have when you don't have a diverse group of people.
And we haven't mentioned travellers living in cramped and awful accommodation. We haven't mentioned direct provision. We saw what happened in meat plants. We saw how it literally killed, poverty killed people.
And we haven't seen, you know, people who don't understand that for some people, the government and the men in white coats are not friendly faces. You know, like, we're like, here, this is the health advice, you should follow it. But there are people for whom the advice isn't always friendly.
Mark, go ahead.
If I can take up what you were saying, Tony and Connor, about class in a tangential way, about representation. So who is private healthcare insurance in this country? If you look at the cabinet, and if you look at all the government, and if you look at the Dáil and senators, probably less so, because they are increasingly more representative. And if you look at the doctors who work in Ireland, you'll see that almost all of them have private health insurance. Now, most of the patients I see don't. I don't have health insurance kind of out of some sort of, you know, stance to try and say that, like, it's not fair if I take it out. Now, I also didn't believe that it actually really mattered to my health up until about 5 or 6 years ago. Now it does. It absolutely will benefit your health. And that's sad to say. I'm like, because waiting lists for certain types of elective care can be really horrendous. And a lot of my friends who are now, I'm over 40 now. A lot of my friends when they're in their late 30s, they were terrified, you know, particularly because of Leo Varadkar's policy that incentivized mm-hmm. people to take out private health insurance that would spend money in a private market. And that was one of the proudest decisions he had as a Minister for Health. It's bizarre. And a lot of my friends...
It's not bizarre if you know Leo Varadkar.
Now, the problem is that thousands and thousands of people have taken out insurance mm. because they're terrified and fearful because of negative headlines. But I can kind of understand that now. And that the hope of Sláinte Care is that you won't need to do that. Yeah. So there's no getting around it. And Connor, you might probably nod at this. What we're saying is that if there's a adequately supported and funded public healthcare system, you don't have to take out private health insurance.
We're getting there.
And only if you like carpet, because that's the difference between the public and the private wards is the carpet.
And maybe infection risk. Yeah,
it's an infection risk.
And it's an infection risk, and you can't wash it properly.
If I can, I'm conscious of time, folks.
Mark, I don't have private health insurance either, because I almost think as doctors, like if you feel that you need it and you work in the public health system, what's that kind of saying about your trust in the system?
Fair play.
And that's why she's everybody's hero. Yeah. We need to bring this to a close, but I would love if we could just maybe ask. So I'm gonna go nerdy with you, Connor, for a second, and ask you in terms of, you know, the work that you do in terms of resilience. We've spoken about vaccinations, COVID. We're all here tonight. We're all vaccinated. We all had our certs scanned, and we also know there's a huge vaccine inequality, and there's talk of boosters. How privileged we are, and yet how much we want to. We need to do better in the wide set of the science. Where are we in terms of vaccine resilience, and how are you seeing this, Connor?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. So at the minute, we're actually running a study on COVID vaccine responses. So the idea. Yes. Niamh is one of our participants, and Kleena as well, and plenty of other people. The idea.
I'll be in tomorrow.
We'll hold you to that. The idea is roughly that stress and trauma and all these other negative experiences, it impairs your ability to actually respond to the vaccine. So we've been doing in a group of healthcare workers and homeless people and asylum seekers as well, is looking at how well they've responded to the vaccine and how well their immune systems have worked to actually protect them. But I do want to touch back to that question of vaccine inequality because I think that's the real question. And it's probably more interesting than the science. At the beginning of the month, Britain had administered boosters to, I think, 9.8% of their population. The continent of Africa, 9.2% of the population had a first dose. So really brutal, brutal situation. But there's a system that underlies all of this, and there's structures that underlie all of this. We're talking about working class voices and identity and representation, but there's much more than that. There is actually, there's structures that replicate those identities over time, and I think they need to be acknowledged. When it comes to the vaccine, those structures, I think, are profit motive. That's a very obvious one. You look at the earnings reports from Moderna and Pfizer that have been published recently. I think there was a Moderna report at something like a 36% profit margin, a company that hadn't got a product before this vaccine. And these vaccines are public goods. You look at Moderna, $2.5 billion worth of public funding went into making that vaccine. It's almost exclusively publicly funded. It should be publicly accessible and available around the world off patents. That's a fact. And you look at where the profits come from too. I think there were $10 billion in advance purchase orders from the US alone. So that's what's making these profits possible. It's this system that underlies it all. And I think it'd be remiss if we didn't acknowledge
Connor,
that.
Connor, and I think that's a really good point, but it's across the board. I spent about a month getting really upset, as you remember on the podcast, because we were talking about Ireland signing up to the 15% minimum corporation tax, and the entire global south was going, this is ridiculous, it's robbing us. It was creating a ceiling rather than a floor for them. But we were like going, aren't we the best boys? We're going from 12.5% to 15%. So it's ludicrous how we treat this. Niamh, in terms of this idea, we spoke no going back, and yet the public have forgotten. It's really sad in my eyes.
But also you have to think about that as a collective response to trauma. So collectively as a country, we're responding to the trauma of the pandemic by forgetting about it. We're suppressing it. It'll come out in some way, other way, shape or form, but we're doing that as a society. But people want to get back to normal, and we want to get back to normal in the hospital system as well. But it's a case of we need to have that fire, like Connor is talking about, to want to make that change and have that motivation to change systems. Because to get back to the class piece, systems work on the working classes. They work for other classes. So therefore we need to, I'm a very working class girl. My dad wouldn't have me any other way. But like, if we're to continue to replicate the systems that have worked on our people, we're part of the problem. So we have to work against that. And I'm sure, like, as a social worker, part of my role is always to be that interface between the system and the person. So to be at that meso to macro level and working with the micro level of the individual. But so you see the impact on the individual and you're trying to ensure that the system is changed. But you have to have a collective force behind you. And that's why Inclusion Health works well, because you have a voice like Kalina. You have voices like Mark and Austin in the community that are saying, this is what's happening. And they have the respect of their class behind them, because that's the difference between me and you.
Yeah.
Essentially.
That's really well phrased. I've got to wrap up. Mark, you said Sláinte Care is not dead. You said Sláinte Care will have to take place in some, but we need, there's people sitting amongst here who are probably going to think that the main issue is we need to push forward in terms of what's happening, in terms of maybe Irish reunification, whatever else is happening. Sláinte Care is going to be a huge problem for the people politically who want to do that. So there's also an opportunity. Where people say there's a problem, there's an opportunity.
Yeah, there's a huge opportunity politically as well for parties to pivot on this really important issue and gain. If you don't care about this, where are you politically? Come on. And I think we need our political parties to really nail down, how are you going to implement it? How are you going to fund it? How is it going to happen? And actually, if I was to fault Sláinte Care, and I'm a huge fan of everyone who worked in it and on it, and Laura McGahey, I do think it was about a communication piece. I think it's about galvanizing that hope, that optimism, describing the problem in context for sure, but also describing exactly what the solution is. Sell it. What is it? It's so complicated. Like, it is so, I'm just bamboozled, like, listening to you, Niamh, about your understanding of the social system in which you're working in. And that's one aspect of our healthcare system. It's really, really complicated. So how are we going to sell this to doctors, sell it to the public, and sell it to the voters? And I think we can do that. I know we can do that, but we do need a communication piece to come in to say, what is the problem? What is the solution? How are we going to do it?
Thanks, Mark. Kalina, last word to you.
So I think that Connor's point about vaccine equity actually picks up everything. So it's a really stupid, in capital letters, thing to do to not facilitate in every way possible everybody in the world to get vaccinated as quickly as possible. It's a huge opportunity to demonstrate solidarity and that we think that black people are as important, their lives are as important as white people, because what we're saying is that the moment is that we don't.
And
brown lives don't matter, clearly, because otherwise we would be going, yeah, here's the recipe, off you go, make the vaccine here, you know. And we're, you know, the same way that all our political decisions around housing, around healthcare, come back and bite us, cutting off your nose to spite your face, as my mother would say, we are doing the same with vaccine equality. So don't cut off your nose to spite your face.
We're going to wrap there, but I am absolutely thrilled to have been joined by the best panel of experts that you could hear anywhere, despite all of the nonsense. Kalina, you are a hero. Mark, you're
not
too bad.
Would you give us a reference, Tony?
Niamh, thanks so much for coming. Connor, I'll see you at the bar. Yes. Thanks for listening, folks. Go grab a beer. Go to the toilet. Rory will be back shortly to talk housing, but please do. And thank you, everybody. And if I could just say one last thing, fingers crossed for Martin's dad. That's the end of that.
Here.
Thank you.